hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now. Now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to talk with Professor Jeffrey Hirsch, associate professor at the University of North Carolina, the School of Law there, about the NLRB and the recent attacks by the radical right. Look, that's been their shiny thing. That's been their diversion point. That's the distraction that they want to. Here's the target. Here's the red meat, crazies. Go after this. Because most people don't know what it is the National Labor Relations Board does and how important it is to keeping industrial peace in this country, and what a great program it's been over the years. Personally, I'm kind of the mindset at this point, the way that the right is going after them just doing their regular course of work is maybe let's get rid of it and take everything back to the streets. But, you know, there's some decisions coming down that, you know, may help workers, which is why the Republican on the board is threatening to resign. Unprecedented. I'm going to quit so nothing can get done. Is what I would expect. But we're going to talk with Professor Hirsch about that. Also in the second hour, Mark Anderson from Daily Kos Labor going to be here talking about what's going on in Wisconsin, the recall effort, their lieutenant governor, who's like ours, a crackpot. I'm really enjoying watching the radical right out there try and figure out how to get around what they've done and the messaging that they're trying to put out. And there's part of me that's going, maybe the moneyed people are going to throw them under the bus, and they know it. So that'll be interesting to find out. Also in the second hour, Abe Amoros, Pennsylvania Legislative Director for the Laborers International Union, LIUNA, going to be here talking about what we need to do to get the economy moving. We need jobs. And, you know, you look at what we talked about yesterday, the state senator from Arizona saying, well, we're going to build our fence, we're going to get it with donations, and we're going to use prison labor, pay them 50 cents an hour and put them to work. Gotta love Arizona. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Appreciate to hear from you. Also, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails. Personally, big news today, possibly a sad occasion. Herman Cain had a conference call this morning with his staff, with his senior staff, said that he is reassessing whether he's going to stay in the race. He said he'll give him the final decision over the next several days. And, you know, you look at Herman, and I've said this all along. He was on a book tour. In states across the country, he had no ground game. He didn't have bumper stickers. He didn't have yard signs. He did none of that stuff. It was a book tour. It was a way to get his name out. It was a way to score points with the Koch brothers, because they're brothers by another mother, if you remember that. It was a way to try and curry some favor with the billionaire class, and maybe the next job. You know, he tried to do this job for a while, being a radio host. Maybe that's what he wanted to get into on a bigger scale. A lot of things that I thought him going in, being president, not one of them. He did his book tour, made a boatload of money. Then he got some notoriety. Then he got some fame. And then someone started looking at him, and he's going, hey, I might be able to be president. Forgetting that, no, everybody's got a past. And as I've said in the past, I'm not someone who looks to you and says, well, you know, I'm better than you. Or follow me because, you know, my example, I'm pristine or I'm virginial. Or as the one state senator from Arizona said, and I kind of agree with her. She says, she's known Herman Cain for years and he has never been anything but a gentleman. And my first thought is, okay, well, you're probably not his type. And she says, you know, I'm not an unattractive woman. Yeah, but you're probably not his type. And she adds that, you know, in politics, we want a virgin to do a hooker's job. And there's some truth in that. We want people who are going to say, hey, we're pristine. We're free from sin. And then when they actually have a past, we beat them up for it. Now, I wish Herman would have come out and said, you know what? Yeah, I made a mistake. And yeah, I had this affair as lots of people do. And you know, the women who came out and said that I harassed them, it wasn't me harassing them. It was me saying, you know, we went to dinner, we flirted around a little bit. Yeah, things happen between a man and a woman. Had he come out and done that, I think he would have curried more favor other than taking the normal stance of denial. Nobody likes denial. People want to, you want honesty. And I think had Herman done that, he'd have been better off. The tweet of the day comes from Andrew, NBC News. He writes, just ask Cain if he plans to leave the race. Responded, 999, 999, we're doing fine. So there you go. what I'm finding funny is the cat fight that's coming out of this Ginger White coming into the spotlight. One of her business partners, because they had done some cycling business together. She's now come out, you know, a scorned business partner, I should say. She's come forward saying that this Ginger White, the woman who said that she and Herman had a 13-year affair, this woman saying that Ginger White never mentioned Herman's name. And I go, well, did you really think you were that good of friends based on your past? Because, you know, generally when people are screwing up, or particularly proud of what it is that they're engaged in, maybe a 13-year affair with a married man, they rarely go into the streets and shout it from the mountaintops. They rarely go out and tell people what they're doing. So I'm not surprised that she never told this woman, especially this woman, who they had had a very interesting relationship as it's being reported. But, you know, it goes back to something my grandfather always said. You know, if you're screwing up, make sure you're the only one who knows you're screwing up, because then you got about a 50% chance of not getting caught, of not being ratted out, because you got about a 50% chance of not ratting yourself out, but generally you do. Other news today, Rick Perry evidently doesn't know what the voting age is, so they're beating him up over that. And again, you know, I guess, you know, as I put on my Facebook page, I know people with pet rocks smarter than Rick Perry. Thought the voting age was 21. So there you go. Consider it a gaffe, a flub, whatever. At least he wasn't like Rick Lazio going after the elementary school kids, like happened several years ago. So, yesterday, did everybody get on their little computer and do the little fingers flying thing? Did you do the Cyber Monday? Did everyone go like sheep? Did we all go to where we were told, you know, like Black Friday, we all got out there Thursday night, an all-day Friday, and Small Business Saturday got out there, and on Cyber Monday. Fact of the matter is, a lot of people did. In fact, saw a 22% increase in sales from last year, according to Comscore Incorporated. They're saying $1.25 billion in sale, which is a big record. According to CoreLogic, they're saying that the average online order, about $200. And you look at some of these retailers who they've got the advantage. They don't have brick and mortar and they're not paying the tax. And someone had asked Rick Scott, the governor of Florida, if it were fair that Amazon has this comparative advantage. And, you know, they asked, what should the legislator do to kind of level the playing field? And Scott said, you know, it's not fair. You shouldn't be treated differently. whether you're selling online or in brick-and-mortar stores, it's not fair. But at the same time, he says, my focus is not to do it where we raise taxes. I don't want to take money out of the private sector. And I'm going, hold on a second. If you have a state sales tax and you're not collecting it from a portion of people who are selling things in your state, aren't you then harming your state? And if you look at what the researchers from the University of Tennessee had to say, the loophole that is this online tax thing has cost states some $10 billion last year. And you know, here in Pennsylvania, you've got the Department of Revenue telling people, hey, you got to pay your sales tax. Send us in the check. Send us in the here's my sales tax from Cyber Monday check. And I'm sure they're going to have enforcement people looking over your shoulder. I'm sure it's coming. So get ready for the knock at the door. After all, we need to keep you people in line. You know, the drillers and those companies who have one of those magical boxes in Delaware, we'll leave them alone. But you make sure you pay your 6% and on time. So that, you know, that designer candle maker you got for Aunt Betty, make sure you pay your tax on. Or the rare DVD collection of the Wild Wild Leave It to Beaver uncut edition for Uncle Ed. Make sure you pay your taxes on that. Because they sure will go after you. Not going after the drillers, not going after the Delaware loophole, going to make sure that those massive subsidies, those massive tax breaks for the very wealthy are well taken care of. You and me, they're going to make sure that they get every dime that they think they're entitled to from us. Other than in Florida, who I guess Rick Scott thinks, yeah, you know, what the heck. Now, doesn't that harm the people who work in your state, though? I mean, if you really stop and think about it, isn't it harming the brick-and-mortar stores on some point? Because I forget who it was. I think it was CoreLogic, but don't hold me to that, who said that 36% of the spending this year for the holiday season is going to be online. So if 36% of the holiday spending is going through this magic portal that does not make sure the sales tax is paid, what's that going to do to the states that are already struggling? What's it going to do to education? What's it going to do to your property tax? What's it going to do to, you know, the roads, bridges, police, fire, whatever? What's it going to do to all of that if we're allowing that revenue to go away? Because, you know, Rick Scott says, well, we don't want to take money out of the private sector. And his goal would be to do away with the tax altogether so you have no money at all. Not going to happen. But, you know, as you're looking at this, you're talking about job losses. And, unfortunately, the possibility of more people unemployed, and there's, you know, we're coming on to another hostage situation, coming up to another deadline, to another crisis. The people with the National Employment Law Project are estimating that by mid-February, about 2.1 million people are going to lose their unemployment benefits if Congress does nothing. And look, the Republicans have no appetite for helping the unemployed. They've already classified unemployed people as lazy and shiftless. They've already put that out there. So they are going to make sure that this doesn't get passed unless, again, we give out massive pounds of flesh to the very wealthy. Like we did the last time. If you remember the last fight over unemployment, which was, you know, the lame duck of 2010, if you remember that, we had to give them the pound of flesh right up front. We had to extend the tax break. We had to extend the Bush tax handouts to make sure that, you know, they were well compensated. So that, you know, well, you know, we had to make sure that they were taken care of before we helped the people who really needed it. I mean, understand, the unemployed needed it. I don't know that the 1% really did. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, this whole thing with the NLRB has just got me angry and frustrated, and I wanted to get somebody on here to talk about the what it's all about, what the NLRB stands for. When we come back, we're going to talk with the good Professor Jeffrey Hirsch. Stick around. Back after this.
Not right wing. listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Teamsters and the Sierra Club have sued recently in the U.S. Court of Appeals D.C. Circuit to block the U.S. Department of Transportation from opening the U.S. border to trucks the union says are dangerous. Teamsters President Jim Hoffa says allowing Mexican trucks free access to U.S. highways means America is now not only exporting jobs, but bringing foreign workers into the U.S. to take more American jobs. The suit alleges the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration is breaking several laws in trying to get the Mexican trucks access to U.S. highways. The suit alleges these trucks pose both a safety and an environmental hazard. Indiana working families are mobilizing against an effort by Republicans to turn Indiana into a so-called right-to-work state. The Indiana AFL-CIO says the legislation is just another attack on working families. The Economic Policy Institute says that right-to-work laws make it illegal for a group of unionized workers to negotiate a contract that requires each employee who benefits from those contracts to pay his or her share of the costs of negotiating them. By making it harder for workers' organizations to sustain themselves financially, right-to-work laws seek to undermine unions' bargaining strength. EPI says when unions are weakened, wages and benefits decline for all workers. Some Minnesota daycare providers and an extremist conservative organization are challenging a governor-ordered union vote. Jesse Russell reports.
A group of Minnesota daycare providers are seeking an injunction to stop a union election scheduled for December 7th. Minnesota Governor Mark Dayne ordered the election in November, but an attorney for the 11 daycare providers alleges that the governor has no such authority. The executive order by Dayne applies specifically to daycare providers that receive state subsidies. That would impact 4,300 providers, but not 11,000 daycare providers who do not receive subsidies. The suit is being filed with the assistance of a conservative anti-union group called Minnesota Majority. In the past, Minnesota Majority has alleged children who attend public schools are being indoctrinated to become homosexuals. In 2010, they released a study alleging that felons voting in the 2008 Senate election between Al Franken and Norm Coleman are the only reason Franken was able to win. That study has been debunked due to three court rulings finding that there was no evidence of fraud in that election.
The Association of Minor League Umpires and OPEIU Guild 322 announced Monday that more than 200 members voted to approve a new five-year labor agreement with Minor League Baseball. That's the first deal since AMLU went on a prolonged strike to start the 2006 baseball season. This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
If the federal government continues to do the kinds of things that this administration is trying to do through the back door, through the National Labor Relations Board, that's killing our free market system.
We're running out of rich people in this country.
The NLRB has become a political sycophant for labor unions.
And one of the things the Congress should do immediately is defund the National Labor Relations Board.
It seems to me that what we're seeing is a ceding of power from Congress to these to the NLRB and other agencies.
It really is a freedom versus tyranny issue.
I'm a member of the GOP, trying to form a plutocracy. But if I can just bamboozle you, point of view, what a wonderful world this
would be. Yeah, what a wonderful world where workers had no rights. And, you know, I'd go back to the good old days where, you know, you had the, you know, the kings and queens and, well, everyone else. And you look at what the attacks that have been going on. The right wing has been in full attack mode of the National Labor Relations Board. And tomorrow is, you know, kind of a lot of people are watching, going to see what happens, because supposedly there's some proposed rule changes coming to where the appeals process is going to be after the elections, which I think is in a lot of cases a good thing. But all eyes are on the Republican on the board. Will he resign? And, well, what happens then? That's why I've asked Jeffrey Hirsch, associate professor of law there at the University of North Carolina School of Law. Professor Hirsch, thanks for taking time for me.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You know, you look at what's going on and the messaging that's going on, and I guess the first question I've got is, what's going on, a grand conspiracy with the NLRB, or is this just them working the way they're intended to work?
No, I mean, it's definitely not a conspiracy. Like other agencies, the MRB can make rules. It's a little unusual. The agency actually, unlike most other agencies, doesn't usually issue rules. It usually makes decisions through cases, but it has done rules before. And the whole idea that there's a problem with the current way elections are run is not new at all. And in fact, you could probably dial this back to the hoopla over the Employee Free Choice Act early in the Obama's term, which is this is really sort of coming out of that.
And to me, I would have liked to have seen the Employee Free Choice Act passed. It would have been one of the, it was the first thing that I thought they should have done to give people the right to collectively bargain and bargain for some of the profits that have happened, because we've seen companies across this country stealing back those hard-fought gains over the last 50 years.
Yeah, and certainly, I mean, one of the things that unions have been complaining about for decades now is that the current NLRB election process is really tilted heavily towards employers. And in fact, you see unions, an increasing number, even of trying to avoid the election process, and in fact, trying to convince employers to voluntarily recognize them. The card check provision in the Employee Free Choice Act would have been a big part of that. That failed, obviously, and what we have now is a much, much, much narrower, much weaker attempt just to simply speed up elections. And that's really all it is to try to quicken the pace that elections are run, and then more importantly, for the very few elections, it's only less than 10% that are even challenged, to try to reduce the appeals process. So if a union does win, they can actually start bargaining for the workers.
Which is, you know, I would think it was in the best interest of all parties involved. You know, I remember being involved in the organizing campaign of overnight transportation when I was a Teamster, you know, years ago. And the Union Pacific Railroad spent $100 million, which would have been more than they would have spent on contracts into the next generation.
Yep.
But it was all about we're gonna impose our will, and you are not going to have the right. And I look at what's going on right now, and the tone, especially from the Republicans, is that workers really don't have rights in this country.
Yeah, I mean, it's ironic that, again, going back to the Employee Free Choice Act, I mean, the complaint about card check recognition was that secret ballot elections are sacrosanct, they're super important, we need to promote those. Well, now we have the board trying to protect secret ballot elections, and they're still complaining. And, yeah, I mean, it just seems that the complaint isn't about elections. They don't want unions, period. Because, you know, again, this is a very, very weak improvement over the current process. There's really not much to complain about if you're on the employer's side.
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of opportunity to harass and intimidate and and berate and fire your employees. And I'm not saying that all employers are like that, but, you know, this decision is for those handful that may be.
No, I that's exactly right. I mean, most elections get the terms and how it's going to be run and who can vote are settled. I mean, it's over 90%. Before the elections even run. We're just talking about really the ones that are challenged, the ones where typically, not all the time, but typically the employers are trying to delay things. And the board's just simply trying to narrow that opportunity a little bit. There's far more things that, in fact, when they initially proposed this rule in late June, there were several other provisions that would have been more aggressive. Most of those have been dropped. This is only a small fraction of the ones initially proposed.
Right. You know, and looking at this, and I'm kind of waiting tomorrow in anticipation to see what Brian Hayes does. Threat of quitting, this threat of resigning, basically rendering the board worthless. There's part of me that goes, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe we no longer have the board, and everything goes to the streets.
Yeah, well, we're going to get that anyway, whether he resigns or not by the end of December when Member Becker's recess appointment expires. So it's just a matter of timing at this point. There's almost no chance that new board members will be approved before the next election. But it's curious. I mean, I don't know what Member Hayes is going to do. If I had to guess, I'd say he's not going to quit. But that's only a guess. The other option that he could do is, rather than quit, simply don't show up. And there's a question, at least, whether or not that would render any sort of decision inoperable. I don't think it would, but there's at least a valid question about that. Or he may come, vote, lose, and then just wait for it to go through the normal challenge process.
Right, because, you know, I got to remember during the Bush years, and there were an awful lot of NLRB decisions I did not agree with during the Bush years, and the Kentucky River cases, you know, pop into my mind immediately where they're, you know, they're basically stealing workers' rights to organize because for 5 minutes today you did, you know, the task of a supervisor, so that precludes you from membership. And I don't remember, and maybe you've got a better memory than I do, but I don't remember the Democrats on the board running for the hills and saying that, you know, we're not going to allow this board to continue its work.
No. In fact, I was an attorney of the board during the early part of the Bush years. And to my knowledge, and I may be wrong about this, but to my knowledge, no board member has ever even threatened to resign or even raised the possibility to deprive the board of a quorum. Now, part of that, there hasn't been that many opportunities until recent years to do that because the board hasn't been only at three members except for certain periods of time. Now, of course, some people I've heard are comparing this to the Wisconsin Democrats leaving town. So I guess there's an argument on the other side of that, too. But
yeah, I mean,
it's certainly unprecedented for the board.
But this is not. This is supposed to be a neutral body.
Exactly.
To me, this should not be a political body. Their work is to keep, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this is about keeping industrial peace and being that arbiter of what's right and wrong in the workplace. It shouldn't be a political thing.
Yeah, I guess maybe in an ideal world, although the tradition of, you know, three members coming from the White House's party and two from the opposing party has always injected a bit of politics into it. But of course, that's become far more serious probably over the last 20 years, where it's just the politics surrounding board nominations become much more heightened. I mean, you used to have more, you know, professors and other people viewed as more neutral on the board, and you rarely ever see that nowadays. It's either union members, you know, people aligned with unions or people aligned with employers. And then these package deals have also ramped up the politicization of the board as well.
Right. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Professor Jeffrey Hirsch, Associate Professor at the University of North Carolina School of Law. You know, the big case also being this, what's going on with Boeing, a little bit south of where you're at. You know, and again, to me, it's not about Boeing. In my opinion, it has almost virtually nothing to do with them. Has the right whether do workers in this country have rights? Do we have the right to strike without repercussion? That, to me, is the bigger issue than whether Boeing opens a plant or they have to close it.
No, I agree. And in fact, I mean, the law involved in the Boeing case is fairly straightforward. I mean, and in fact, the vast majority of times, employers can open up businesses and new work wherever the heck they want. What they can't do is make that decision based on an attempt to restrict workers' rights. And that's the allegation at Boeing. I mean, you had several executives say that point blank. And in fact, the general counsel should have been criticized if he didn't pursue this case. But obviously that, you know, the politics entered on the Boeing case. Boeing's a very sophisticated employer with a long history of labor issues. And so they've ramped things up. And in fact, I suspect to a large degree a lot of the mess involved with this election rule is coming out of the Boeing matter. I think this would have gone under the radar more if Boeing hadn't been an issue.
And, you know, again, what the issue being is the right has kind of grabbed onto this and saying, well, this is Obama paying the big labor contributors, which in reality, I mean, if you any rational person who looks at what this president has done, I don't know how you could make the argument that he's paying back big labor since their number one priority was never even discussed, which is the Employee Free Choice Act.
Yes, if that's the case, they should get their money back.
Absolutely.
I mean, the first bill he signed was an employment discrimination bill. That was somewhat helpful. But, yeah, as far as unions are concerned, he even took quite a while to appoint new board members. A general counsel has never been officially appointed. The current one's in acting. I think in a lot of ways, I mean, not entirely all Obama's fault. He's obviously had a lot of resistance. But this has not been a particularly successful period for them. There's been some pullback from a large amount of damage that was done during the Bush administration. But the idea that somehow this is what the board is doing is unique is ridiculous. I mean, you know, there's a term during the Bush administration of the September massacre where there was, you know, like a dozen cases or more that the board reversed some rulings over 40 years old. So this is small potatoes compared to what was done during the previous term.
Yeah, I wish labor and I wish working people would have reacted with the same type of visceral reaction that we're getting from the right during that time frame.
Yeah, exactly.
I just wish that to be the case. And you brought up the Lilly Ledbetter Act.
Right.
I would make the argument that labor got very little out of that because women who are protected under labor contracts, they don't have to worry about that. Everything's defined. Everything's right there. That's for people who aren't in labor unions and don't have a contract.
No, that's exactly right. Times some theory might be that the more protections that individual employees get, that's the worse for unions because they perhaps have less benefit to workers. The big thing was the Employee Free Choice Act, and that, it looked like at one point maybe there would be a settlement, but that obviously fizzled out, particularly after Scott Brown was elected.
Let me ask you a last line of questioning. In looking at the board, because I do believe in the concept of the board and the work that they do, in looking backwards, because there's been a lot of attacks on them, what, in your opinion, is their charge? What are they supposed to be doing, and are they doing it?
Yeah, no, I'm somewhat biased, of course, as a former employee of the board. Their ultimate charge is to enforce the National Labor Relations Act. That includes unfair labor practices by both employers and unions. I personally had cases against unions that overstepped their bounds. And to run elections, and they generally do quite a good job. And the vast majority of cases fly under the radar. Nobody hears anything about it. Now, I think there's been a lot of what their ability to do has been limited by the statute, which hasn't been amended in decades, and by courts, which have largely done quite a restrictive reading of the Act and limited what the board can do. So the law itself, I think, is somewhat limiting. But the board, and obviously there are certain periods where they've done more and other periods where they've done less, has overall done a good job.
In looking at the board, going back pre National Labor Relations Act, pre board, what kind of conditions did workers see in the workplace before you had this? Because there's a lot of people who are saying we need to get rid of it. It's no longer useful. But I think it's important to go back pre National Labor Relations Act and understand what the conditions were during that period.
Yeah, they were deplorable. And of course this is putting. The NLRA was one of the first big national workplace acts. It was sort of one of the switch in time that saved nine that finally broke through with the New Deal in the Supreme Court. And so you had, horrible safety conditions. The Triangle Reuters fire where scores of women died because doors were locked and things like that. You had extreme violence, on both sides as well. There's some great labor movies that detail that. Huge strikes that really gummed up the economy. There were all kinds of things. It was chaotic in a lot of ways. I think getting rid of the NLRA would be worse for workers than for employers. But employers should watch what they ask for, because there's going to be some cost to them as well. Again, there are limits in the Act to what unions can do. One of the primary purposes in the Act is to preserve industrial peace. Although I should note as well, right, the other main purpose of the Act is to promote collective bargaining and the idea that workers, there's an unequal bargaining power naturally, and that collective action and collective representation can address that.
And that's the other part of the attack. And you look at the attacks that are going on from the right, and it's all about taking your right away to that very thing, the ability to bargain over wages, hours, and conditions.
That's right.
Professor Hirsch, always great talking with you. I would love to have you back on again as this decision goes on and the NLRB continues the attack. It was great talking to you.
My pleasure.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. I'll be right back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
The rich, as F. Scott Fitzgerald put it, are different than you and me. If you doubt it, go shopping. Specifically, make two outings into the wonderful world of retail. Start with middle-of-the-road and more downscale stores such as Bell's, Walmart, and Target. You'll find customers, but fewer than normal, and they're spending less than they would have a couple of years ago. Welcome to the real economy, where paycheck-to-paycheck families are barely holding on, worried about their jobs, mortgages, gas and food, and other basics. This is not going to get better anytime soon. Corporations aren't hiring, wages are stagnant or actually falling, the price of basics keep rising, and people's savings are depleted. In response, Walmart officials are saying they're not even passing on price increases like they always have. And they're offering a layaway payment program this season so their hard-hit customers can still purchase a few holiday gifts. They note that many shoppers are saying they won't even have much in the way of holiday meals this year. Now, check the scene at Neiman Marcus, Saks Fifth Avenue, and other upscale stores where the stock market set goes for stylish shoes and designer gowns and the like. Blessed with executive salaries and a good tailwind from the Dow, these high-end shoppers exude confidence in their financial futures, so their shops are bustling with buyers, and no one is rummaging for bargains or even inquiring about discounts. Full-price selling, exults the CEO of Saks, is at record levels. Trying not to gloat, he adds, I feel good about the luxury consumer. This is Jim Hightower saying the industry refers to this widening divide as a, quote, bifurcated market. But what it really reflects is a bifurcated America, with a hard-pressed many going one direction and the flush few going another. That's a dangerous divide for America's democracy and for all of our people, including the rich.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Everybody's got a price. Everybody's going to pay.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, you look at this NLRB thing, and, you know, the right has just been foaming at the mouth over this. Because it is one of the last places that workers actually can get a fair shake. And there are, you know, there are people who say, you know, maybe we need to do away with that for a while. Maybe we need to go back and have those battles again. Because if you go back and you read American labor history, some of the bloodiest battles you have seen in the world. You look at Wisconsin. What sparked that whole occupation in February was the governor of Wisconsin saying, I'm going to call out the National Guard. And the people who've had just a touch of labor education, just a touch, they know that when a governor says, I'm calling out the National Guard against workers, that does not end well. History has shown a lot of bloodshed. And they took to the streets. And rightfully so. Maybe we've got to fight those battles again. And like last night when I talked about the Teddy Roosevelt quote. Learn those battles all over again. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. I got Ike on line one. How you doing tonight, Ike?
All right, buddy. Just trying to hang in there. Yeah, those battles got to be fought again. We've let them creep, you know, creep back in the door, and they're stomping us in the ground. And my only question's been is, you know, what's it going to take, and how long is it going to take? And I can't believe it's gotten all the way to the point where it is now.
Well, you know, a good number of people, 85%, if you will, 85% of the people still have things to lose. You know, you go back to the Great Depression where, you know, people were basically starving in the streets. That's what saw the big wave of organizing. Maybe we need to feel that kind of pain. You know, you go back to the old saying, you know, sometimes your stomach's got to be empty before your head gets right.
Having sat on unemployment for 99 weeks.
So. But you're from South Carolina. I mean, Boeing created all kinds of jobs down there. Didn't you get a job at Boeing? I hear there's thousands of them.
Yeah, that's the kicker. I'm only like, 4 miles away from the plant. I created jobs, but, the selection process was, rigorous, and, they actually put a lot of the workers through, They made them go through, I don't know how many weeks of training over at the tech school, which as far as I know, I don't know that that was paid for training. I believe that came, there was some arrangement made where they paid part of it and the people that went to school paid part of it. But, you know, it's just convoluted. I mean,
let's face it, man,
they don't make it easy for anybody to get a job these days. And let me give you an example. In the construction trades now, they abuse the 1099 subcontractor rule to the point that if you do get a job, they want to pay you cash, and then they file a 1099 on you as though you're a subcontractor, which is highly illegal. But it's been done that way for a long time. That's how they used all the illegal Latino labor that they've gotten accustomed to. If they don't do that, then in other jobs they go, well, you know, we don't hire anybody directly, so, you know, you need to go file through this temporary service. So this temporary service can screen out the unwanted that we don't want, shield us from legal liability, give us a tax write-off on the expense, and oh, by the way, they're going to take a couple of bucks out of your pocket every hour that you work to pay for the privilege of having the job in the first place.
Welcome to America.
And then if they don't, and then if they don't do that, then they go, well, you know, you need to go onto our website, and you need to submit your resume, and data, when there's a lot of people that don't have computers, or if they do have computers, can't afford the cable hookup, or down on their luck to the point that they don't have any way to use a computer, unless you want to go to the library and try to jockey around 1 hour at a time, and you get a max of 2 hours every day to be able to use a computer in the first place. You know, I mean, they just put so many impediments up. And then on top of that, I mean, you know, I cruise Craigslist. That's what I've been using, trying to find work. And I actually saw one the other day that they wanted somebody to help out in the yard for a couple of days or like a week or whatever it was. And they were basically going to run a background check on you, you know, and I'm sitting here going, okay, well, what's next? You know, am I going to have to pee in a cup to dig a ditch?
Yep.
I mean, you know, it's just one thing after another, and they made it more complicated than what it should be in, you know, in the first place. And oh, by the way, if you were sitting in church and you broke wind when you were 9 years old, by the way, we don't want you because you're not the type of person we're looking for.
Well, I mean, this is how things have gotten.
That's what it is. That's exactly what it is. And you bring up, by the way, you bring up Florida and you bring up the unions and et cetera. You know, my sister's down there. She's three years away from retirement. She spent her lifetime as a special ed teacher. And she's just holding her breath, but for the last 3 years that she's there in that job, she will not get a raise at all. That's something that the legislature passed.
Right.
And she's holding her breath because, with the kind of money that she makes, she's topped out evidently. So that makes her a target, you know, and of course the non-union, you know, screw the worker, attitude of the Republicans, particularly that criminal that they've got for a governor, you know, if they get a chance, they'll dump her.
Oh, of course they do. And that's the move across the country to get rid of all of the qualified teachers, especially the older ones, because after all, they cost money because they're old. Let them get their own health care somewhere else. And hey, we can get some 20-year-old to come in and do the job for pennies.
Well, you know, I've seen all the tricks. I went to labor school and I've seen a lot of tricks companies pull, you know, all the way down to, companies once the union contract comes up and they don't want to go through the negotiations or the unions make demands on them. I've seen them actually transfer ownership and just sell the company.
Yep, we're lucky.
Basically just do it as a piece of, you know, it's just a paperwork finazzle, razzle-dazzle. It's nothing, it's not even a real sale. But they do it, and as long as they change ownership on the paperwork, then it all goes back to null and void, which, you know, I look at American Airlines, and I really feel sorry for those folks because I know what they're fixing to get hit with.
No, they're going
to
get screwed. Their pension's going to evaporate.
But listen, in closing, you know, as dismal as it gets, you know, we've got a little movement here. We've had 10 of our people got arrested in Marion Square in Charleston, Occupy Charleston. They went to court this morning. And, you know, it's not an easy road to hoe. And yeah, it's tough, but I got to tell you, With the news that continues to come out, particularly with this thing with the Fed and the $8 trillion they handed out, and how they hand it out for the big wigs, but they don't help anybody else down here on the bottom, you know, there's a boiling going on below the surface here, and I've got a feeling that this is what I've been waiting to see for the last 20 years, and I've got my fingers in it, and anybody else out there listening, keep your fingers in it too. And if you're not in it, you need to get involved in it because, you know, the numbers don't lie, and these people need to be brought down a couple of pegs.
I'm right there with you, brother. Amen. I appreciate the call. Always great talking to you.
Have a good night, buddy.
Thanks so much. No, you're absolutely right. It's what I think a lot of people have waited for. This finally the awakening of working people. And I've often questioned why, especially in the construction industry, you know, why people put up with it. You know, why do you put up with the independent contractor status? Why do you put up with the third-party logistic company? Why do we put up with it? Basically, because we don't have that mentality anymore that my grandfather's generation had. That idea that we are all in this together and collectively, we can make change. Gonna take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Rick Smith Show.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make everything happen!
Dear John Bank, I am so sorry it has to be this way, but there's just no choice. I wish circumstances were different, but I can't hide my feelings any longer. I'm in love with another, and you just don't compare. I got tired of you taking advantage of me, charging me higher and higher fees, and raising rates behind my back. I did love you so, but now we have to break up. It's hard, but the right thing for me. I'm with PSECU now. This credit union treats me right. That's all I ever asked for, to be somewhere I belong.
If you're ready to break up with your bank and take back what's yours, we're ready to help. Call, click, or come in. You can join. Go to PSECU.com/befree and see where you belong.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Question, comment, something on your mind, just want to vent. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, or you can give us a call here, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. I got an email during the break. A guy sent me this. He doesn't know where it comes from, but it's a great quote. I like it. It says, give a man a gun and he'll rob. He can rob a bank. Give a man a bank and he can rob the world. And, you know, you go, isn't that exactly what happened in September of 2008? Where we basically just handed over the keys to the kingdom, telling these bankers, oh, please, please don't crash the economy. And you look at what Bloomberg News has come out with. And you know, you go, really? You know, why aren't people doing the perp walk? Why is no one going to jail? Former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson who was at the helm. He had his hands on the levers. He knew what was going on back in 2008 when the financial crisis hit. Evidently, he leaked inside information regarding the government's takeover of Freddie and Fannie to a couple of his hedge fund buddies, one of his former buddies over there at Goldman Sachs. Now they're saying that there's no evidence that the traders used the information. But they're saying as tracking firm specific short stock sales isn't possible using public documents, but at least one trader contacted a lawyer and was told that Paulson's talk was material non-public information and he should stop trading immediately, should stop the trading of Freddie and Fannie. And as Reuters' Felix Selman put it, Paulson was giving inside tips to Wall Street in general and to Goldman types in particular, exactly the kind of behavior that government Sachs conspiracy theorists have been speculating about for years. And, you know, look, it's been a swinging door with the Goldman people going in, taking over those jobs in the department. And at some point, I think we have to break that swinging door. You've got to attract and keep good people. But if they leave to go to Wall Street, they don't come back. Sorry, not happening. Once you leave, there's no swinging door. Because you look at what's going on over the last several years. I mean, we have bailed out the banks. We have, you know, I've said it before. We don't have any more bank robbers. You know, every once in a while, you'll see a silly story of some idiot who walks into a bank and misspells a robbery note or fills out an application before he robs the bank. And he gets caught, and he's going to do years for doing something dumb. But, you know, all of our colorful people, they became CEOs. There's no more Pretty Boy Floyd. There's no more Bonnie and Clyde. They're all CEOs now. They robbed the bank by pulling the truck up to the back door. And by saying, oh, we're going to crash your economy if you don't give us the money. That's the holdup. That's the heist. That's the robbery. That's the theft right there. The other theft? Look at those Bush tax cuts, man. The handouts that the Bush administration gave out. Jeez, oh, man. And then Obama allowed himself to be held hostage last November. Remember that? The lame deck session right after the 2010 election just to get a little bit of unemployment for people who needed it, people like Ike who needed it. The Republicans were willing to let folks go the winter months starving. Why? Got to make sure that those tax cuts, those handouts for the millionaires and billionaires, got to make sure that those are right and just for them. And if you go back and you look at the numbers, the numbers being what they are, if we just raised a little bit, and I think, you know, these two Nobel Prize winning economists, Peter Diamond and Emmanuel Saez, according to their research, they're saying that the top marginal tax rate, which is now 35%, should actually be double that, should be 70%. And if we did that, you could actually move GDP by a significant amount. And you could use that additional money to help people at the bottom of the scale, bring them up, add the consumption, and have an economy that's moving. They said, you know, even if you can't get to that 70%, which is impossible, understand, it's going to be absolutely impossible. I think you would have a better chance of you know, bringing Keith Moon and John Entwistle back to play a live concert with The Who. Never going to happen. But if you didn't raise it up, according to their research, to at least 43.5%, you could raise GDP, you could raise revenue by 3 percentage points of GDP, which would A, help you with your budget deficits, and B, still give the very wealthy twice as much as they had in 1970. But we know it's not going to happen. And you look at the Bush handouts. That one percenter, that person right there at the top, that one percenter, in 2011, they're going to get a tax break larger than what the 99% of this country earned in the entire year. So their tax handout, $66,384, going to be vastly more than the earnings of the 99%, which averaged $58,000. Explain to me again how that's good for the economy. You look at the news today, American Airlines filing bankruptcy. Whole bunch of reasons why. Number of people flying down, price of fuel through the roof. But what's going to happen here, and you know it's going to happen, and you got to imagine that the workers here are going to have to know it because their pension fund is $10 billion short. And you know that the bankruptcy judge is going to set that all aside, as they have done numerous times, and it's going to be on the backs of the taxpayers. These people are going to end up on the backs of the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. And you've got, I guess American Airlines has four traditional pension plans. They cover some 130,000 workers and retirees. Now, these workers, these retirees, these folks, they could lose almost immediately as much as $1 billion in benefits. That is a huge amount of money. That's a huge wealth transfer. And that's really what this bankruptcy stuff is all about. It's a wealth transfer. Those were wages that were foregone in the hopes that, you know what, I'm going to have a decent retirement. Which is another reason why I'm against companies holding your pension plans, which is why I've always been in favor of a national pension system that we all pay into. But again, there's something else never going to happen, because of course you're going to have people who are going to underfund it, and that's part of my problem with national health insurance. My worry is that you get what may be coming in the future: a Republican president, Republican governor, Republican Senate and House. And you end up seeing them starve the programs, as they've done. I mean, the NLRB is a perfect example of them starving the beast. The EPA, the FDA, you go down the list of all of the agencies that they have starved. And that's the game plan. But this American Airlines bankruptcy, to me, is huge news. I mean, this is going to be the largest default of a pension plan in the history of the country. And again, what it is, you know, all those people now, what, 30-40% of what they were supposed to get, they're going to end up with, and you and I, the taxpayer, are going to end up paying for. Because these companies were allowed to underfund, these companies were allowed to play shenanigans, and, you know, the CEO, he got paid pretty well up until he resigned. We really, really need to start looking at how business is done in this country. And I go back to what Teddy Roosevelt said, what I read yesterday. We need to be regulating these companies heavily, because they're a construct of we the people. We, through our government, allow them to exist for the good of us. Not for their own existence, but for the good of the nation. I know. They give us jobs. No, they don't give us anything. We work for that. I'm so sick and tired of hearing the right saying, well, you know, the job creators give jobs away. They don't give anything away. You work for those. You make them profit. If you didn't make them profit, you wouldn't have a job. And we need to start thinking in that frame again and stop with this, oh, we need to kowtow to the huge corporate special interest. Enough already. Gonna take a quick break, right back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
EI says when unions are weakened, wages and benefits decline for all workers. Some Minnesota daycare providers and an extremist conservative organization are challenging a governor-ordered union vote. Jesse Russell reports.
A group of Minnesota daycare providers are seeking an injunction to stop a union election scheduled for December 7th. Minnesota Governor Mark Dayen ordered the election in November, but an attorney for the 11 daycare providers alleges that the governor has no such authority. The executive order by Dayen applies specifically to daycare providers that receive state subsidies. That would impact 4,300 providers, but not 11,000 daycare providers who do not receive subsidies. The suit is being filed with the assistance of a conservative anti-union group called Minnesota Majority. In the past, Minnesota Majority has alleged children who attend public schools are being indoctrinated to become homosexuals. In 2010, they released a study alleging that felons voting in the 2008 Senate election between Al Franken and Norm Coleman are the only reason Franken was able to win. That study has been debunked due to three court rulings finding that there was no evidence of fraud in that election.
The Association of Minor League Umpires and OPEIU Guild 322 announced Monday that more than 200 members voted to approve a new five-year labor agreement with Minor League Baseball. That's the first deal since AMLU went on a prolonged strike to start the 2006 baseball season. This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
What the hell we fighting for? Just surrender and water it all. Just got time to say your prayer.
And welcome to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Something on your mind, question, comment. You look at the big story today, Urban Meyer. Urban Meyer hired as the Ohio State University football coach. Again, you know, you look at this and the money that they spent, an absolute obnoxious amount of money to get this guy to come out of retirement. A $4 million contract. A $4 million base salary. That's the base salary. Now, think about it. To be in the top 1%, you need to make $2 million a year. This guy is doubling that. A football coach. Come on now. He is now in the top 1% of the nation. $4 million base salary per year. Bonuses up to $700,000 a year. And lump sum payments. In the years 2014, 2016, 2018, could be over 6 years worth at least $26.65 million a year. That's not even including the money that they spend on his automobile stipend, his country club, golf club membership, 50 hours of private jet use. And, of course, 12 tickets to each home game, which I guess he could, you know, out in the parking lot before the game, scalping those. You know, because, you know, he needs a little extra cheese on his Whopper. You know, $26.6 million, you know, may not go as far as some people may think. You may need to get out there and hawk the money. And, you know, you look at this, and the president of the university makes $1.3 million, which I think is outrageous as well. But you've got the football coach making $4 million in base salaries with all of these bonuses. I got to tell you, there's something seriously, seriously wrong. This has turned into you know, just massive industry. And you look at Ohio. You look at the money that they're gutting from public education. You look at the fact that they're pushing for vouchers and they're pushing for privatization. And I guess Kasich gutted looks close to a billion for a football coach. The guy from Texas, over $5 million a year. He's the highest paid guy. I'm going, really? Is that the priority? And I guess in Texas, I understand it. I understand because, you know, that's supposedly all they've got there, and along with oil. But, you know, $5 million bucks, I guess. They don't care about education. You look at the numbers, they're near the bottom. But Ohio, man, what have you done? And, you know, you go back and you look at Meyer, who was, I guess, a graduate assistant at Ohio State back in the 80s. And the guy who hired him, the coach who hired Earl Bruce, he earned $87,000 a year. Now, to me, that sounds more reasonable. You know, back in the 80s, $87,000, yeah, brought in a good sum. Brought in a nice, you know, a nice chunk of change. I'm sorry, I'm just not getting $4 million at a time when we're talking about gutting payments for education. And here in Pennsylvania, talking about privatizing it. And I don't know if you saw this story. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reported today that the Catholic Diocese of Pittsburgh, they evidently one of the principals were told that they should tell all the parents in the district that they should be lobbying their state legislators. Because, you know, you got to pass this bill. This email went out that said we must be relentless in our efforts to help pass school choice this year. He says, I'm asking you to inform parents that have received tuition assistance that they must contact their legislators and return the contract form attached with the date they contacted them and the decision that they've got, or they're not going to get grant money next year. Now, the diocese is running away from this. But, you know, you're all the folks who may be getting a buck or two from the church to be able to send their kids to the Catholic school, getting their arms twisted, that's what it's come down to. And people wonder, why hasn't the Catholic Church come out against privatizing the wine and spirit shops? Why haven't we heard a peep from the folks of the religious community about that? I said from the beginning, and you go back, you listen to the tapes months ago, I bet there's a deal there. We'll get you the vouchers. You shut up about the wine and spirits shops. We can privatize the whole thing, and the profiteers will just walk off with the assets of this state. Now the diocese is saying, well, you know, it was a motivational thing. You know, he just maybe went a little bit too far. A little bit too far. Had they not gotten caught, you know, and it still may be going that direction. Where now what you've got is you've got a scenario where these parents are in a bind. They're the folks who are going to be pushed and pulled. And why? Lots of tax money. And this voucher thing, huge money. I mean, it's amazing to me. There's all of this money out there to tell us why we need vouchers. There's all this money out there to pimp privatization. There's all this money out there for K-12.org and cyber this and charter that. But there doesn't seem to be enough money to fix what problems it is that we may be having in the public system. Because it's not about saving public education. It's about destroying it. It's about tearing it apart, and it's about profiting from.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. Listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
just before the election, they had this lovely consultant guy come in and tell us all about what the hell we were getting ourselves in for.
Cussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Sorry about Wednesday, y'all. We kind of broke with tradition, and I didn't get to tell the night before Thanksgiving story, and well, gosh, it all just sucked. But the fact of the matter was, when the interweb tubes go out here, there ain't not just a heck of a lot going out there from here, that is. So my apologies, but we certainly do have plenty to go into and cuss and discuss about this evening now, don't we? Yeah, and then some. Before I forget, right off the bat, a humongous thank you goes out to Janie, who took care of 15 slots in the Thrifty 250 right before airtime today. Thank you very kindly. And with that, I can note to you that we need 60 more people to do $10 a piece between now and Wednesday night, and we will have taken care of November. We will get in under the wire. We will finish November in the black. So it would be wonderful if that could happen. That's 20 people a night. And this program note, speaking per night, tomorrow night is another one of those very special evenings. A gentle reminder that we will have a Dr. Bill American History Chat featuring Dr. Bill O'Brien and Professor Keith Lilly tomorrow night beginning at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time here on the Horn. And I heartily encourage you all to attend and listen. Yes, this is a program that is geared toward people participating in the PRISM West Virginia American History Program. And so there will be a little bit of housekeeping, maybe 15 minutes or so, something like that. But the vast majority of what you get is information, American history, that you will not hear anywhere else. And that I dare say you would be hard-pressed to go and find for yourself. Not that you couldn't, but it's just it's a matter of going and looking. And golly, there's a lot of stuff to look through. So that will be taking place tomorrow night at 7 p.m. I hope you'll join in. And then, of course, we will close out November on Wednesday, the 30th. And we're just keeping our fingers crossed. It will be a little bit dodgy during the first half of this month. I have to be gone for some mountaintop removal activism-related business in the second and third weeks of the month. It will be... Well, it'll take me away from the microphone, and I hate that. But that's just it. That's how it is. As I've said before, I couldn't sit here and tell you about the horrors of what the coal industry are doing to Appalachia if all I was doing was sitting and talking about it. Because little recovering Southern Baptist that I am, I heard often growing up down there in the basement of the Baptist church with little old blue-haired ladies tell you all the good stuff about religion and wait until you get upstairs for you to find out the tawdry, nasty business. Be ye hearers of the word and not doers, be ye doers of the word and not hearers only. See, it's been a while. Be ye doers of the word and not hearers only. And I have to be a doer. And I can't just sit here, and I guess you would modify that for my purposes and make it be ye doers of the word and not talkers only. So yeah, I gotta walk the walk if I'm gonna talk the talk. So that's gonna take me away from the microphone in the second and third weeks of December. But then we'll cruise right downhill to the end of the year, with little or no interruption, hopefully. Okie dokie. So that's where everything stands at this point. It is hard to believe. It's Moran Monday again. It seems like we had barely finished one up, and then the just dealt with the leftovers on Tuesday, and here we are again. Of course, we had all the madness of Thanksgiving. I hope, and let me say now, I hope you all had a lovely Thanksgiving. I know some of you did not. I got a heartbreaking email from a listener apologizing for not contributing to keep things going here. Oi, oi, and pointing out that this year they could not even afford a turkey at Thanksgiving. And it made my heart feel like it was made of sinking stone. But I hope that in being together, you were able to have a happy Thanksgiving. It was quite the jaunty mess around here. I will never be the kind of chef who has everything perfect and out on the table all at the same time. No, I think I would require a phalanx of stoves for something like that. But we had the turkey, which was perfect. And we had the dressing, of which I think there were about 50 pounds. You know, dressing is the ultimate poor people's food. It's made out of stale bread, easy to obtain seasonings, and broth or hot water, and maybe some celery and onion. And, you know, people do oysters and chestnuts and things like that. And we never stuff the bird. It's just nasty. But dressing, yeah. Cranberry sauce, mashed potatoes, sweet potato croquettes. The traditional household banana pudding for dessert. That's something I added, just because the kids love it and my father did too. I hope you all had a joyous time together. It was nice to get a little bit of a break. It really was. On Friday, I watched my beloved Mountaineers play their last ever installment in the backyard brawl against hated rival Pitt. You know, we won't be renewing that rivalry that's been going on for 134 years and has been played 104 times. We won't be renewing that rivalry next year because it's more important for Pitt to go to the Atlantic Coast Conference and more important for WVU to be playing football against Texas Tech than it is for us to maintain historic traditions 134 years long or 117 or whatever. And the Mountaineers came out ahead. So now if Cincinnati can win out, we can go to a BCS bowl that we don't deserve. It was a nice, relaxing time. Of course, in the midst of all the nice, relaxing times, well, what? Yeah. It's why we have Moran Mondays, isn't it? Kinda is. Because, God, the Morans came out on... Thanksgiving was barely over before the Morans came out. But I have to promote to the head of the class, even though there are other Morans, almost equally deserving, I have to promote to the head of the class. Damn it, where's that drum roll when I'm looking for it? Oh, well. Kansas governor and former United States Senator Sam Brownback. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, it's Moran Monday on the horn. Hurry, 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 step right up, for less than the cost of one thin dime per hour of programming, you too can tell the Morans. You can't tell them without a program, and this is the program that tells the Morans. You can always tell a Moran, but you just can't tell them much. Hurry, 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 step right up, waste no time. Women with small children are advised to stay on the outside of this thin cybernetic veil that stands between you and utter moranity. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Ladies, do not set your purse down around the morans. They are right-wingers, and what you won't give to them, they will happily take. Watch your wallets, gents. It's Moran Monday on the horn. We have big morans, little morans. Can